I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The World Cup starts tomorrow with teams from 32 countries competing in venues all across Brazil. Thursday's game pits Brazil against Croatia in São Paulo. While soccer fans are ready for a month of games, many Brazilians have been frustrated by the cost and inconvenience of hosting the sporting event, especially as the country's economy stalls. There have been strikes and protests and concerns about the problem-plagued preparations. FIFA, the organization that runs the World Cup, has come under withering criticism, accused of corruption and hardball tactics. We'll be talking about all of this in this hour of Radio Times, and we begin with Gabriele Marcotti for a preview of the team's and the players to watch. He's an analyst and writer for ESPN FC at the World Cup and a columnist for the Times of London and the Wall Street Journal. He is joining us from Rio. And Gabriele Marcotti, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
So how do things look in Rio? Does it look like that city and that country, Brazil, is ready for the World Cup?
Yeah. You know, this is a familiar ritual every 4 years. So, you know, sorts of concerns about whether this will be ready and that will be ready. And there's a whole bunch of public works projects that did not finish on time and won't be ready, like the subway here, or the extension of the subway here in Rio. But the reality, I think, is in terms of getting, you know, fans and people around, if you've been said today that the stadiums will be ready, they are ready, and the airports have been upgraded. So in that sense, you know, that won't be a problem.
What is it like? We don't have the greatest phone line, I have to say, but we're gonna persevere with you, and hopefully it'll get better as we keep talking. How though, as someone who's going to cover the World Cup, how do you cover it in a country as big as Brazil when there are venues and stadia all over the country?
That's a great question. The reality is you need to pick your spot. I'm fortunate that, you know, ESPN are sending me around to various venues. Generally, you know, there's no way you can catch every game in person. So you try to look for the biggest teams. You base yourself in a certain city, cover the games that are there, go to the training camps that are nearby. And certainly in the early going of this World Cup, you cover FIFA, the games governing body, which of course is under the midst of tremendous controversy right now.
Well, indeed, and we're going to be talking more about that controversy. In fact, we're going to give you a quick call back, Gabriele, because it is not a great phone line, and I want to give our listeners a chance to actually hear what you have to say. So let me just do a quick re-ID while we call Gabriele Marcotti back, and we are getting a preview of the World Cup as starts tomorrow, and it runs for about a month. We're getting an update from Gabriele Marcotti, who is in Rio. We'll be talking a bit with Dave Zirin. He's a sports editor at The Nation, and he's had some very critical words for FIFA, as have other sports people and others as well. And then we'll be finishing the hour with a conversation with Michael Reed, and he's a writer for The Economist, and his new book is a look at Brazil, both Brazil's rise and some concern about its troubled rise as a global power. So we're covering pretty much all bases in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the World Cup. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And we know that the United States struggles to find some enthusiasm for this support. The U.S. is playing in the World Cup, although the team has not been given a lot of chance. In fact, the coach of the team doesn't think that his team has a chance of doing particularly well, which is an interesting thing coming from a coach at a world event. So we are talking about the World Cup. And again, you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499, and we are still trying to find Gabriele Marcotti. He is actually a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, and again, an analyst and writer for ESPN FC at the World Cup. In fact, he's joining us from Rio, which is why it's sometimes hard to hook up with people when they are in far-flung parts of the world. And again, he's a columnist for the Times of London and for the Wall Street Journal. I used to play soccer, actually, as an adult, played in a co-ed league. I wasn't particularly good, but it certainly was a very fun Sunday morning when we would spend an hour and a half on the field playing soccer. And I think we have Gabriele Marcotti back. Let's see if this is a better line. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
I think that's a little bit better. Let's talk a bit about Brazil and also talk about a hometown advantage. Is the team of 2014 as good as the team that played in South Africa?
I mean, it's not as good as previous Brazil teams. There was some level of skepticism around it, but they did win the Confederations Cup, which was held here last summer, which is a warm-up to the World Cup. And they beat the reigning world champions, Spain, quite emphatically in the final. I think a lot of the concern with this team is that, some of these players who are starters, who are regulars, they don't actually get much playing time at club level. The goalkeeper, for example, Julio Cesar, he was playing in the English second division, wasn't getting a game. He was a backup, and ended up moving to Major League Soccer in Toronto, which certainly raised some eyebrows whether somebody at that level could be good enough to keep goal for a team that expects to win the World Cup.
How do you expect things to go tomorrow when Brazil plays Croatia?
Well, there's going to be tremendous pressure on them, as there always is. I actually expect Brazil to go far. There's a wonderful backstory to Brazil, which is what happened the last time they hosted the World Cup back in 1950. At the time, much of the rest of the world was rebuilding after World War II. They went through the tournament, got stronger as it went on, and dominated everybody. They played Uruguay in the final in front of an official crowd of 177,000,
wow.
Unofficially more than 200,000, the biggest crowd ever for a sporting event. And they were leading 1-0 late into the game, and they let it slip away, and they lost 2-1. And the Nelson Rodriguez, the Brazilian poet, an essayist and playwright, he said it was... it was like the Hiroshima of Brazil.
Oh, my goodness.
He said, given that we're a country that never went to war, this was the biggest tragedy we ever faced. And they're trying to erase the ghosts of that. And, one thing you realize is that in soccer, people have very, very long memories. So it's a lot of guys, 1950, seems like yesterday.
And how about the team from the United States? I know they got a tough draw, but how do you see them as a team and even their coach? And I know he got rid of, he pulled a player that was considered a star player for the U.S. team.
That's right. The draw wasn't kind at all to the U.S. men's national team. To give you an idea, if you go by the FIFA rankings, which are purely mathematical, but... the U.S. is in the group with Germany, who are second in the world, Portugal, who are fourth in the world, and Ghana, who are, I believe, 34th, but who are still a tough out. The manager of the U.S. team is actually Jürgen Klinsmann, who previously was the manager of Germany. He was the manager of Germany in the 2006 World Cup. And he'll be facing his former assistant, who's now in charge of Germany. So there's a whole backstory there, but he certainly made a controversial decision in leaving out Landon Donovan, who has been really the iconic, or one of the two iconic U.S. players, I think, in the last decade, along with Clint Dempsey, leading him out before the World Cup, saying with Donovan, he was either going to be a starter, but he didn't really see him being a bench player, and he wasn't prepared to give him a starting spot. That seems to be the suggestion lines out there, and I think Clinton's going to live or die by that decision.
Gabriele, we're going to have to say goodbye to you only because it just is not a great phone line, and I apologize to our listeners for that. I apologize to you as well, and perhaps we can catch up with you at some later date. And thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Not your fault. Again, Gabriele Marcotti, he's an analyst and writer for ESPN FC at the World Cup, and he is down in Rio. He's also a columnist for the Times of London and the Wall Street Journal. Joining us now, as I mentioned earlier, is Dave Zirin. He's sports editor at The Nation, also the host of Edge of Sports Radio for Sirius XM, and he's got a new book called Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. And Dave Zirin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. How's the connection?
The connection is so much better. I can now exhale, so that's much better. And Dave, it's nice to have you back on the show. Let me ask you, because it sounds like you are a soccer fan, as many people are around the world. How do you reconcile your love for soccer with what appears to be your hatred for FIFA?
How do we recognize our love for anything and reconcile it with the ways in which institutions of power can warp those things to such a terrific degree? I mean, I love music, but we could do a week of shows on the ways in which the music industry has both destroyed artists and corrupted it and branded it within a half an inch of its life. I mean, we could do that about food. We could do that about architecture. I mean, there's so many ways in which the products of our society are rife with contradictions. I just think with sports sometimes people adopt way too stringent an approach where it's either you accept everything or you boycott it and push it away like a vegetarian pushing a plate of meat away from the table. When I think what we really need to do is separate what we love about sports from what we don't like about sports and challenge sports to change.
Well, even just picking up on that, I'm looking at the clock here about a minute and a half before we have to take our first break, Dave, but what do you love about soccer?
What I love about soccer is that it's the beautiful game, of course. It's the people's game. It's a game that actually, with the exception of some of the United States, unites the world like nothing else. It's a game that anyone can play, no matter how much money they have in their pocket. And it's a game that can bring out the best, most creative impulses in the people who love athletics. It's difficult once you fall under the spell of soccer to disengage.
Did you play as a kid or even as an adult?
I did, certainly. I was a goalie because I'm not fleet of foot. That's also why I was a third baseman and a first baseman in my baseball team. Anything that involved not moving my feet too much. But, you know, it's like I loved playing. I do love watching. And I hate what FIFA is doing to the beautiful game.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation and talk more about FIFA. And we are getting a bit of a preview of the World Cup. It begins tomorrow in Brazil. You probably know that. Dave Zirin, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. And again, he's sports editor at The Nation, the host of Edge of Sports Radio for Sirius XM. And he's got a new book called Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And I do want to talk with Dave Zirin about FIFA, and we want to hear from you as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or were the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Brad Meltzer is a best-selling thriller writer, but when he wanted to write about the biggest, most heroic adventures he could think of, he turned to children's literature.
To my daughter, Amelia Earhart isn't some black-and-white figure from a history book. Amelia Earhart is alive, and she's brave, and most important, she's fun.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smart ideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Dave Zirin about the World Cup, about FIFA, and we will be talking about Brazil as well. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Dave, you had a piece in the New York Times recently, the headline, Throw FIFA Out of the Game. But you write about its humble beginnings back in Paris in, 110 years ago, in 1904. What was its origins about?
Well, it's so interesting because FIFA and the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, the organization that oversees the Olympics, are now basically like conjoined twins. They're very similar in terms of their secrecy, their corruption, and the ways in which they run roughshod over nations. Yet they couldn't have started as two different kinds of organizations. The International Olympic Committee started with the most pompous possible airs you can imagine. It was started by aristocrats with a lot of blather about the ways in which sports will rehabilitate the nations of the world, and there's a lot of sort of imperial and white supremacist ideology that went with the starting of the International Olympic Committee. FIFA just started because people wanted to figure out what the rules of soccer were.
Huh.
I mean, it was as simple as the fact that soccer was exploding in popularity at the end of the 19th and at the start of the 20th century, yet there was a lot of confusion about what the rules actually were, because a lot of countries incorporated their own popular sports into what soccer was. So some countries played in a way where you could use your hands. Other countries made it kind of like rugby, and you could just straight tackle people when they were dribbling down the field. And what FIFA set up to do is to be like, okay, if there's going to be this thing called soccer, and if we can foresee nations actually playing against each other, then we need to figure out what the rules of this game actually are.
How, though, has FIFA gotten the kind of power that they seem to have to call the shots? We're learning with Brazil is that they've changed some of the rules and laws of Brazil so that they can have stadia that are built a certain way. They can serve beer in a stadium, which apparently they can't do under normal circumstances in Brazil.
Right. I mean, for the last 10 years, this has been the law in Brazil to avoid death. And FIFA came in and said, no, Budweiser is one of our key sponsors, and they had a bill pushed through the Brazilian Senate. Similar acts were done in South Africa in 2010. I mean, FIFA got the South African government to pass trademark laws that banned the illegal use of the words World, Cup, in 2010. And the South African government was charged with actually seizing any product that they saw that contained the words World, Cup, or 2010. And so it's this idea that FIFA and the IOC as well, they effectively become these stateless actors that assume autonomy over your country and actually abrogate the sovereignty of different countries. Now, how did they achieve this power? Well, of course, they couldn't achieve it on their own. They lack a standing army, for goodness sakes, of what sometimes feels like a military kind of an intervention. But what they do is they do it with the consent of the governing powers in a given country, and the governing powers tend to use FIFA and the IOC, or more aptly, the World Cup and the Olympics, as what I call in the book a neoliberal Trojan horse, like ways in which to push through development projects and all sorts of also, in the post-9/11 world, surveillance operations that people would otherwise reject and be in up in arms about, yet because it's wrapped in the guise of the World Cup or wrapped in the guise of the Olympics, it becomes the sort of thing that's acceptable.
You're talking about the tearing down of favelas in Brazil.
250,000 people are going to lose their homes. The favelas is just one part of it, though. It also is about drones, surveillance drones flying over the country, 1,000 new street cameras in Rio de Janeiro alone, and the arming of more troops in Brazil during the World Cup than the United States had in Iraq and Afghanistan during the 2000s. So we're talking about what amounts to a kind of a mission creep operation where all of, and I saw this with my own eyes in London, Well, all of this new research and development and surveillance equipment comes to the fore, and yet when the games are over and the confetti gets swept away, as one police chief said to me in London, said, well, it's not like we're going to put this back in the boxes, are we?
Mm. Does FIFA, I mean, how much money do they normally make from the, for since we're talking about the World Cup, how much money do you think they are expected to make out of the World Cup in Brazil this year?
I wish I had the figures in front of me, because I just read a report yesterday that FIFA is actually going to make considerably more than they thought they were going to make in Brazil. Their rosiest projections of how much money they were going to actually profit from being in Brazil, from all of the, not just tax-exempt status, but all the corporate sponsorships. I mean, FIFA's reserve in the bank, which is billions of dollars, is going to be much better than they thought. And this is galling for people in Brazil, because it's the opposite reality in Brazil. It's going to cost more than people thought. There's going to be more debt than was assumed. There's going to be more hardship when the World Cup is done, particularly with the 2016 Olympics in Rio right around the corner. And so that is one of the things that's inflaming a lot of the protests on the ground.
Do you think countries going forward will think twice about hosting a World Cup for all the reasons that you've been talking about, Dave Zirin? Or is there just a certain kind of honor to be the host country of such a huge global event?
Well, it's a very good question. I can say for the Olympics, there was recently a lot of embarrassment in that only two countries bid for the 2022 Winter Games, and they were China and Kazakhstan, both countries that are, of course, autocracies. And I think that that says something in and of itself, that some of the bloom is off the rose of countries lining up to host these mega events. And the reasons for that, I really do think, are rooted in post 9/11, not security concerns, but security costs. And the fact that, I mean, there's too much local opposition. I mean, that's why the next Olympics aren't going to be in Chicago, the 2016 Summer Games, because there was actually a movement in Chicago to keep them out. And I think you're going to start to see that in more and more countries. And this is why the both FIFA and the World Cup, I mean, one of the heads of FIFA actually said this openly, that it's much more attractive to put a country, to put a, put these games in a country that's a dictatorship, because there's less formal opposition. And the more they start going to dictatorships around the world and autocracies around the world, even more luster gets taken off the kind of pomp that surrounds the games.
But Brazil is not a dictatorship.
No, it's not, but it's only, this is one of the things, of ways of understanding the protests that are taking place, because Brazil is also a very new democracy. I mean, there's less than 30 years that the country is removed from dictatorship, from decades of dictatorship. And so when FIFA comes in and starts exerting what frankly looks like dictatorial control with lack of democratic oversight, it touches a lot of very, very sensitive points amongst the Brazilian population, with that memory and echo of the dark days of dictatorship all of a sudden seeming like more than a memory.
In fact, Dave, from some of your reporting and in your book, some of the protests in Brazil are saying, you know, we want FIFA-quality wages, we want FIFA-quality schools, we want FIFA-quality hospitals.
Yeah, and that's a direct reference to FIFA's demand when they came into Brazil, and this is FIFA's demand when they go anywhere. It's like, Brazil is a country, of course, that had no shortage of soccer stadiums. And yet FIFA said, no, 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 we need FIFA-quality soccer stadiums, which means built to a certain standard and, frankly, a certain luxury that they felt like Brazil's stadiums did not possess. Now, I'll tell you something. It's not that the Brazilian leadership cried over the fact that they would have to build these new stadiums. In fact, Brazil's leadership oversaw the building of even more new stadiums than FIFA even asked for. And that's because this is where you get to the other side of this, which is not that Brazil is like this sort of a victim in this process, but that, you know, there's real social inequality in Brazil. And the wealthy in Brazil, the powerful, and namely the real estate concerns, people can look up a company called Odebrecht, B-R-E-C-H-T, which is one of the main funders of political parties in Brazil, They wanted these Olympics. They wanted these construction projects. They wanted these development deals because it meant mega profits for them. What was thought in Brazil was that the economy was so red hot in the 2000s that they could manage to, you know, both, you know, have, for lack of a better expression, they could both pay Peter and pay Paul. They wouldn't have to rob Peter to pay Paul. Yet the economy has slowed down dramatically. The projects still need to go on time, and that's what's led to people saying, well, wait a minute, how are we having FIFA-quality stadiums and not FIFA-quality hospitals and schools?
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Dave Zirin, our second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the World Cup and Brazil. He's sports editor at The Nation, host of The Edge of Sports Radio for Sirius XM, and author of a new book called Brazil's Dance with the Devil, The World Cup, The Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. We have callers coming in at 1-888-477-9499. In fact, let me get Brandon from Flemington, New Jersey, to join us. Brandon, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I've been going to Brazil for 15 years. My wife is actually from there, and I work with our Latin American and Brazilian operations in my company. And I was just there two months ago, and I have to say that I've never felt so much pessimism and anger from people there, just kind of talking from my colleagues, from my in-laws, and people there are just... Quite honestly, kind of just, I guess it's like a personally echoing what Dave said, is that the local population is really just disgusted with the level of resources that have gone to that. And when you go there, if anybody's ever, you know, visited Brazil, the infrastructure is an absolute mess. The schools are terrible. The public health care system is a mess. So really what people thought probably 8-10 years ago was going to be Brazil's coming out party, they see as just a moment of great shame and embarrassment for the country, given kind of all the corruption and all the, kind of their priorities being out of whack.
Well, Brandon, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and it sounds like a knowing yes from you, Dave Zirin.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I've been to Brazil a great deal and spent a lot of time there for the purposes of writing the book. And one of the things that I think is really stunning are some of the poll numbers that are coming out right now, which, of course, echo what everything the caller said. I mean, this is Brazil. Let's remember this. The country that is the global standard when it comes to soccer, a country that has won more World Cups than any other country on earth. And one poll shows that a majority of people in Brazil hope the national team loses.
Wow.
I mean, that is stunning. I mean, of course, you know, we could debate whether the poll, methodology, blah, 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 but the mere fact that that's even, like, out there and that nobody's like, that poll is ridiculous. I mean, it is really stunning. 67% of the country opposes the way in which the World Cup has been implemented. 61% think that they wish that the World Cup had never just been there in the first place. I mean, this is a stunning turnaround from a country that was celebrating in the streets when awarded the World Cup. And it's for the very reason the caller said. And this is actually, Lula deserves, the former political leader, deserves a great deal of the blame for this. And that he set up a set of expectations for what the World Cup would mean. Not just sort of the normal things like jobs and the rest of things like that, infrastructure. But this is Brazil's coming out party. This is about Brazil being a top-tier nation, and now let's talk about being on the UN Security Council. Let's talk about being a co-world power with the United States in the Western Hemisphere. And all of these things that Lula said that the World Cup would be symbolic of has actually now been turned on its head, and instead it's symbolic of something quite different.
Do you think, though, Dave, that, let's say, Brazil wins the World Cup, people might think differently about the event?
I still think people would be profoundly conflicted. I mean, and I'll tell you why, for two reasons. And by the way, that question you just asked is the subject of much discussion right now. What happens if Brazil actually wins?
Right.
Two reasons I think people would still be very conflicted. I mean, the first is I think that there is a great deal of political sophistication in Brazil with regard to the social movements and really separating what's being done to Brazil from the actual play on the pitch itself. And the second thing is people have to realize that, I mean, people are being alienated from soccer in Brazil. It's not just anger at FIFA and the government. It's tickets that people can't afford. I mean, people who are in Brazil, the whole country is being set up for foreign tourists, the development projects, everything. It's about using Brazil's culture as an instrument of foreign consumption and not as something that, that people can actually experience for themselves. And so unlike, say, in 1950 when Brazil hosted the World Cup and roughly one-tenth of the city of Rio de Janeiro was packed into the Maracanã Stadium for the final against Uruguay, this is a situation where people are going to be not only on the outside looking in, but really cordoned off by an entire exclusion zone around the stadium. It can't even get close to the action.
A couple of more minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. I'd like to go back to FIFA, and I just have a couple of questions. One about charges of game fixing, of secret payments, even questions about how Qatar won the World Cup in the year 2022, when in the middle of the summer it's something like 120 degrees. Now, I'm assuming you build, you know, you build stadiums with roofs on them, but nonetheless, does the Qatar, I guess, decision tell us what we need to know about FIFA?
Tells us everything we need to know about FIFA, and it might be the case of FIFA just getting hoisted with its own petard, because I think the combination of the protests in Brazil and FIFA being really pulled out of the shadows and people looking at FIFA as really part of the problem here and not this kind of anonymous shadowy figure behind the scenes, a combination of that and the Qatar scandal, I think, has FIFA at its most perilous point in its history, and with a real chance of not only its leader Sepp Blatter being held to account, but also the entire organization.
But are there efforts, do you know, within FIFA or maybe sort of on the outskirts of FIFA to change the organization?
Well, the European branch of FIFA, which is the UEFA, UEFA, is actually standing against Sepp Blatter as he attempts to run for re-election of the organization. That he's what was thought was going to be a rubber stamp re-election is actually going to be challenged. So that's something in and of itself. But that to me is really just almost like, you know, changing, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, because systemically there's a problem with FIFA. And I think that the Qatar situation, if they try to go ahead and do this World Cup in Qatar, and there's already talk of moving it from Qatar, but if they go ahead with it, I think you will see a rebellion amongst a lot of the leagues in Europe, and if that against FIFA, and if that takes place, then what you have there is a crack in the cartel. And if the cartel gets cracked, that's, I think it'll just leak like a sieve.
A cartel that's also a nonprofit.
Nonprofit with over $1 billion in the bank.
Well, Dave Zirin, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's sports editor at The Nation, also the host of Edge of Sports Radio for Sirius XM, and he's got a new book called Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. The World Cup does begin tomorrow in Brazil, and we have another guest waiting in the wings to talk more about Brazil and its relationship with its neighbors, a bit about its history as well. So do stay with us and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
I've got the key to the highway.
Brothers Phil and Dave Alvin, formerly of the Blasters, have recorded their first album together in about 30 years. It features songs by bluesman Big Bill Brunzi. On the next Fresh Air, the Alvins perform in our studio, tell us how they first discovered the blues, and we talk about Phil's recent near-death experience. Join us. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
How the small world of a conflicted dentist becomes the universal search for truth.
He's at great odds with the city. He's sort of raised both fists at the universe.
The story of Job for our time, Joshua Ferris's To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, our first book club discussion on faith, humor, and our journey to know who we are. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about the World Cup, more precisely talking about some of the politics of the World Cup. American Pharaoh is a new documentary that follows Princeton athlete Bob Bradley on his journey as the Egyptian national soccer coach. And you can watch that on TV 12 Monday, June 16th at 10 p.m. Joining us now is Michael Reed. He writes the Bellow column on Latin America for The Economist, is the newspaper's writer at large for the region, and in fact edited the Americas section for The Economist for 15 years. He also has a new book called Brazil, The Troubled Rise of a Global Power, published by Yale University Press, and he joins us from the studios of The Economist. And Michael Reed, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
You're very welcome. Is Brazil ready for its coming out party, which begins, I guess, tomorrow?
Well, clearly, things have been rushed, have not been terribly well organized. But I suspect that once the first ball is kicked and once the kind of football narrative takes over from the protests and the disorganization, I suspect things will go not all that badly. I mean, yes, there will be some protests. Yes, there will be some, no doubt, some problems that the fans may experience in some cities with public transport. There will be petty crime and so forth. But I think for Brazil, on the one hand, clearly the organization of the World Cup has shone a rather cruel spotlight on the country's shortcomings. But on the other hand, there's a more positive side to the story in Brazil, which is about the way in which poverty and inequality have fallen. Democracy has got stronger. I think the country is at a turning point in which people are making demands on the government and on the state for better public services, and that has been crystallized by the World Cup.
And I do want to get to all of that, but do you see the protests and the strikes and a bit of the even the criticism coming out from Brazil about the World Cup as in its tied to rising expectations? Yes, this was a dictatorship just a couple of decades ago. It's a new kind of baby democracy, a feeling its way through the world of democracy.
Well, it was a dictatorship 30 years ago, but yes, I think there's a lot in that. I mean, I think that the protests. There were very, very big protests last June in which up to 1 million people were on the streets, and they were really a demand for the political system to respond to people's demands for better health, better education, better public transport, less corruption. And people felt that the use of a lot of public money for the World Cup, the fact that 12 stadiums were built when 8 would have sufficed, mm-hmm. all of that summed up a deep-rooted feeling of discontent. But I think the protests now are slightly different. I mean, I think the country is this underlying mood of discontent. But a lot of the protests now are kind of opportunistic. There are people going on strike because they know that the government will give in just at this moment. And there are some kind of radical social movements that are pushing their demands, their own demands. They're not on the scale of the protests that we saw last year in Brazil.
And just a bit of Brazil, I guess, geography and history here. We're talking about, the fifth largest country in the world? It's the size of the continental United States. People might not know that. And also the seventh largest economy in the world.
That's right. And it's the fourth most populous democracy. And it's surprising for a country of its obvious weight and importance in the world how relatively little known it is. And that's perhaps because they speak Portuguese rather than Spanish. For whatever reason, I mean, I wrote my book because I felt that there's a general sense out there that, you know, people realize Brazil has become important, but, you know, people know remarkably little about it. And it is a country with its own distinctive history. It has a strong sense of exceptionalism, like the United States. In some ways, it's like the United States seen through a distorted mirror.
Huh.
It is a country which is... it's a cliche to say countries are at turning points, but I think it's true in the case of Brazil. There has been a lot of progress in the last 20 years. You know, people are no longer worried about inflation and unemployment in the way they were in the past. But, you know, these new worries about better public services and so on are a sign of progress, I think.
A sign of progress because some of these sort of basic needs are being taken care of, and now people, especially in a democracy, they want more?
That's
they
right.
They want better?
Absolutely, and they're quite right to want more and better. And, you know, Brazil is historically a country that's had a kind of top-down state. You know, they're rather unlike the U.S., where it was, you know, a citizens' revolution that made the nation, and it was the constituent states that formed the federal government. In Brazil, you know, it's been from the top down.
Mm.
And here we have a rather important demand from the bottom up, a demand for equal citizenship, if you like. And I think it's partly been because, well, there was a lot of progress under Lula and under his predecessor, Fernando Henrique Cardoso. That was in the 16 years to 2010. And I think Dilma Rousseff has been rather disappointing for Brazilians. The economy has more or less stalled. The government collects an enormous amount of tax revenue but doesn't spend it very well. And Brazil is going to need a new round of reform of the state, of public spending, of politics, of the political system in order to push forward at a faster rate down this path towards that it has found, but it's a path on which it's going rather slowly towards a more middle class, more prosperous, more equal society.
You're saying the president's policies are holding Brazil back?
Well, I think she's not really grappling very effectively with these demands, which are demands for political reform. They're also demands for, as I say, reform of the state. Brazil spends far too much money on pensions, on insiders, on there are all kinds of veto players in the political system who grab a big slice of public money. And you know, and I don't think she has shown herself. Really, to be aware of the challenge involved, and also I think her management of the economy has been less impressive.
Mm.
It hasn't been disastrous. I mean, one of the things about Brazil is that it's you know, it's not heading for collapse. It's just a question of whether it's going to live up to its potential or whether the next few years are going to be rather mediocre.
That's Michael Reed. He has a new book called Brazil, The Troubled Rise of a Global Power. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, let me get Jonathan from Abington to join our conversation. Jonathan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Jonathan, and I'm actually the photo editor for a new quarterly U.S.-based soccer magazine called Howler. And I wanted to echo your guest's comments at the start. You know, I think... a lot of recent sporting events, such as the Sochi Olympics or even London, you know, in Sochi was all about the preparations. All the media bathrooms weren't ready, and, you know, the security rings there and in London. And I think before the event starts, there's a lot of this kind of talk in the media about, you know, issues. And, of course, Brazil has many issues. But I think, as your guest said, once the, you know, the kickoff happens tomorrow, a lot of that will fade away. Of course, if things, you know, turn worse, that's, you know, another matter. But
well, I appreciate, Jonathan, I appreciate your comments. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Michael, any thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, I think there's, you know, there's clearly a risk that things could go wrong. But and we'll have to wait and see how things look in a month's time. But but I suspect that we need to distinguish between, you know, the underlying demand for change in Brazil, the underlying discontent, which has been catalyzed in part by the World Cup, but is only in part about the World Cup. And you know, once the football gets going, Brazilians and people around the world will get interested in it. And I think that, you know, you'll still have a lot of people in Brazil who will feel that all of this wasn't worth it. But I think you will also have, particularly if the Brazilian team does well, people will feel a little bit less negative about it. And I would just make one comment apropos something your previous guest said. I think, you know, of the 12 new stadiums, four of them are scandalous white elephants that should not have been built. But I think others, you know, will be used fully, you know, in Brazil, and will be assets. I mean, I think it's a legitimate question: should public money have gone into them? Were they a priority? But you know, the legacy won't be wholly negative.
Let me get Daniel from Princeton to join our conversation. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I apologize. I missed part of the show, so you may have commented already. But Michael, I would appreciate if you could comment on some of the human rights issues, particularly related to U.S. companies that are having very public campaigns for promoting social outreach in various favelas. At the same time, they're covertly funding the pacification police. So in a sense, they're manipulating the very population that Brazil is trying to keep at bay from the venues.
Your phone is not as clear as I'd like it to be, Daniel. I'm looking at the computer here. Major U.S. beverage companies in the favelas have supported the police. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, and this is going to have a long-term impact on the human rights issues in the favelas, but we don't hear a lot about these corporate sponsorships. They're trying to be friendly to the community at the same time, supporting police who are basically government employees.
Well, Daniel, let me give Michael Reed a chance to respond. Thanks for the call. Michael, go ahead.
Well, what I would say about the pacification program, and you're talking here about Rio, which is, you know, one city in one state in Brazil. It's a city that for 50 years was very badly governed and very, very badly policed. For the first time in the past few years, there's been a serious community-based policing program, which involves trying to disarm and root out these violent gangs, drug mafias, which have controlled many of the favelas for a couple of generations. Now, that program is not flawless, but it's by far the best policing program that Rio has seen. And, you know, Brazil is a democracy. That program enjoys a lot of popular support, including in the favelas, which is not to say that, you know, there haven't been problems with it, but it's the right direction to go in, and I think, you know, that is the overwhelming view of people in Rio de Janeiro.
Daniel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Michael, how do you see the relationship between Brazil and the United States?
It's complicated and it's bewildering because it kind of ought to be better in many ways. I mean, these, after all, are the two largest democracies in the Americas. As I said, they're in some ways quite similar. You know, it's not that they're enemies. I mean, they are, you know, both would claim to be friends. It's just that they're rather distant friends and they find it very difficult to see each other as allies and partners, you know. And I think there are a series of reasons for that. I think each wants different things from the other. I think, you know, the U.S. would like Brazil to be the kind of sheriff of Latin America, as it were, and that's not a role that Brazil wants to play. I think Brazil would like the U.S. to see it, to give it kudos as a kind of global power that's relevant on global issues and not just on regional issues, and the U.S. doesn't see Brazil that way. So, and then you get a series of issues as arise in relations with, you know, international relations from time to time, the latest example being the Snowden revelations about the tapping of President Rousseff's phone, which caused enormous irritation in Brazil and so on, you know. So it's, as I say, it's a relationship which is not bad, but it's one of enormous frustration, and it could be much better.
There's a presidential election in Brazil later this year.
Absolutely, and I would say actually for Brazil and for Brazilians, the presidential election is actually much more important than the World Cup. And the outside world is obviously focused on the World Cup. But I do think this election will be very important for Brazil, because President Rousseff's party, the Workers' Party, which is left of center, has been in power as part of a broad coalition for 12 years now. And there is growing discontent in the country. The opposition, there are two opposition candidates who are former state governors. And Brazil, like the United States, and unlike most other countries in the Americas, is a genuinely federal country. And state governors are important, you know, they have power and money. And they often do innovation and so on, as happens here in the US. So I think President Rousseff faces a very serious challenge. And I think the election is wide open. And I think any one of the three could win. And I do think Brazil could go in kind of slightly different directions, depending on the result.
Are you optimistic about Brazil's future? Too soon to tell?
Former President Cardoso said it's a Brazilian pattern for hope to be followed by disappointment. You know, it's a country that has a remarkable ability not to live up to its potential, but the potential is always there. I do think it's been living up to the potential much more. I think it's run into some problems. I think it needs to fix those problems. And it might, you know, bizarrely, if the situation was worse, it might be easier to fix the problems. I think part of the problem is that Brazil's not doing all that badly, so that makes it harder in a large democracy to mobilize a coalition for change. But I am moderately optimistic.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Michael Reed, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. He writes the Bello column on Latin America for The Economist, and he has a new book called Brazil, The Troubled Rise of a Global Power. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, email, archives, satellite radio, and how to sign up for our newsletter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.